Whoever wants to go first, go.
I might kick off. I'm Jamie. I go to Saturday EV. I've been here for maybe 8 years, maybe even longer, maybe 10 years. I work at Mingara. In fact, this October for me will mark 10 years there. So,
wow.
I know what you're thinking, and it's true. I started there when I was 12. No, I really enjoy it there. Love working there. Excited to be here this morning. I brought along my friend from Mingara, Teresa, who's a nutritional expert, and we're excited this morning to talk to you a little bit about health and fitness, and looking forward to doing that.
Thanks, Jamie.
I'll go second then. My name's Teresa. I'm a clinical dietitian and nutritionist. I work at the gym and I'm also a personal trainer. So I kind of get to do the nutrition side and the exercise side, teach classes as well. So I guess I've been working in the industry, well, since straight out of uni, so about 4 or 5 years now. And I've kind of worked in a couple of different areas. I thought I really would like to work in a hospital, and that's what I tried to do for ages. But I ended up falling and absolutely loving working with the community. So I do a lot of private practice, a lot of work with the community, community roadshows, members events, masterclasses, and I would really like for you to be able to share my passion of loving food, so that good relationship with food. Yes, absolutely loving food, including pancakes.
Good morning. My name is Andrew. I'm a regular at church here as well. My wife is Melanie Martin. For those of you who come, you may know her. We've been coming together here to the church for probably 11 years. We have 3 kids, 8, 6 and almost 4. I work at East Gosford. I'm a podiatrist. And my business partner and I have been there for about 11 years as well. That's when we came to the coast. We deal with all aspects of podiatry, so we do a lot of aged care. We do kids, we do biomechanics and sports podiatry. We do a lot of nursing homes and hostels and travel around. And today we're going to be having a look at footwear. It's a topic we could talk about for hours and hours and hours. So hopefully today we'll just bring up some questions and get you all thinking without actually having the time to answer everything in great detail. But at least we'll get thinking about our shoes.
Good morning. My name's Jason. I'm married to the beautiful Kate, who's not here this morning. I work locally as a physiotherapist. I've spent the last 6 years in practice. I've worked in the hospital system, so down in Sydney in Westmead, Gosford. I've been part of a larger sports medicine clinic on the coast for about 5 years, and I've just recently gone out on my own in a private practice with a group of doctors locally.
Hi, my name's Lynn Hayes and I'm a GP. I work in practice at Lizaro. I've been on the coast for about 18 years and we are foundational members of the church. Met in the very first meeting in the lounge room, which was really exciting. Came up from Sydney, from Gladesville. And it's been just wonderful to see how God has grown the church. We have 3 children, 2 of them are youth leaders here, Andrew and Brittany, so some of your children might know them. And our daughter Stephanie's in Sydney. And looking forward to talking to you today.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to have you. I guess I just wanted to start and say to you ladies, why are we doing this? Why are we doing a session on good bodies, keeping your body fit and healthy? Is it that we want to be beautiful? Is it that we want to have the perfect body? And I want to say that's not what we're doing here today. And it's not even about making life the best that it could be. As Christian women, there are different reasons for caring for our body. James says, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change with shifting shadows. Life, our every breath, health, having a body that works, being fit and strong, are all great gifts from God. And as we acknowledge that, we want to look after them. Corinthians also says, do you not know that your bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You, that is your body, is not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, we want to honour God with our bodies. Our bodies are the vehicle for God's Spirit, the God creator, the Almighty. And Jesus, in his sacrificial death, has given us eternal life, but our earthly life here is the house for our spirit. Paul also says training the body has some value. So looking after our body is valuable. But we know that being godly has far more value because it promises to give us life eternal. So that's the basis of what we're going to do here. But what we're going to do today is very practical. So we might start with Lynn, our GP, and she might just share a little bit with us. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. So thanks for inviting me to share with you today from my GP's perspective of looking after your bodies, which are the temple of the Holy Spirit, and we should honour God with what we do and how we care for our bodies. So what regular checkups should we attend to? The aim of having a checkup is to detect diseases early so you can modify risk factors and also to try and detect cancer early. So as women, we have a few particular checkups that we should do. If you are planning a pregnancy, it's a good idea to see your doctor and discuss that. Get a look at what sort of vaccines you might need. Are they up to date? Medications, any illnesses that you may have or family may have. You can get advice about staying healthy and supplements you might want to take, such as folic acid, which prevents neural tube defects. As women, we should be undergoing regular pap smears. These are designed to be there for early detection of cervical cancer. And these are performed every 2 years. The target age is about 22 to 70. So if you get to 70 and you're all fine, you can resign from pap smears.
Yoo-hoo!
or they start 2 years after you become sexually active. So then mammograms is the big one for prevention and detection of breast cancer. The target audience for that is 50 to 70 years of age, and the mammograms are done routinely every 2 years. But if you have a history of breast cancer or even ovarian cancer, you may need to start this earlier, and so see your doctor to discuss what's right for you. All women should be breast aware, so get to know your breasts, and if you find a change, such as a lump or a discharge, bleeding or pain, then go and see your doctor to get it checked out. 90% of lumps in the breast are benign, so don't panic, but be sensible. An early diagnosis gives a better outcome. Then we've got checkups that are applicable for all adults, and these should start from about 18 years of age. Look after your teeth and see your dentist regularly. Also monitor your skin. If you get any new skin lesions, get them checked out. And if you have a mole that changes in any way, also have that looked at. And you should have your blood pressure and your weight checked about every 2 years. Then from the age of 45 years, we start looking more at risk factors for diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So these would involve regular looking at your weight, body mass index, your blood pressure, cholesterol, and fasting blood sugar. Should do this routinely about every 2 to 5 years, but people who start to develop diseases will need more monitoring. From the age of 50, we're starting to look more for cancer, and bowel cancer screening comes in place. You'll be sent out kits from the government at the moment every 5 years from 50 years of age. Do those. That's a great free service. A lot of people throw them in the bin. 80% of people are throwing them in the bin. They cost money and they may save your life. The recommendation is actually to have screening every 2 years for bowel cancer in that way routinely. But if you're at high risk, then you may need a colonoscopy and they may need to start earlier. So there's certain people that might need to talk to their doctor about that. We're looking more for kidney disease, which includes looking for protein in the urine. And then eye diseases start to become important to look up, to look for glaucoma and also macular degeneration. And these are potentially curable causes of blindness. So they start from about 50 years of age. Get a checkup every 5 to 10 years at your optometrist or your ophthalmologist. But if your family has a history of glaucoma or macular degeneration at an early age, then you may want to get this checked up early because it could happen to you as well in the same way. And then we are also concerned about bone strength. So we look at risk factors for osteoporosis, and doing bone density scans, really useful screen for that and for monitoring about every 2 to 5 years, depending on the individual. So then once you get to 65, we add in routine vaccinations we encourage everyone to have for influenza, pneumococcal pneumonia, and also the shingles vaccine is recommended, although not funded by the PBS. But it will be, I think, in 2017. Then hearing and vision are really important. So if you're having any problems with your hearing or your eyesight, then go and get them investigated. And also if you're on medications, you should have them reviewed regularly. So what are the most important things you can do to keep healthy? Well, first one would be not to smoke. And if you don't smoke now, that's fantastic. Don't start. And if you are smoking, stop. Eating well is really important. And I've brought here a little picture of the healthy eating pyramid, which has actually changed a bit. You can have a look at it later, but I'll just describe what it is. The idea is that the majority of the foods are on the bottom layer, and they're made up of vegetables and fruit and legumes. So you should have 5 servings of vegetables and 2 of fruit per day. The next most food, you should have a grain-based foods and try and have whole grains and unprocessed grains. Then there's the dairy products, and you should have 3 to 4 servings per day of dairy products, which are good for calcium, and high-quality protein foods such as meat, eggs, nuts, and fish. I particularly flag fish for you. They are really good at preventing heart disease. At least 3 servings per week of fish will help your heart. And then at the top, very small amounts of good oils. So canola, olive oil, that kind of thing. Limit your salt and your sugar intake, and encourage water drinking. The other thing to focus on in your diet is a good fibre intake. And you need 30 grams of fibre per day. And I think Therese is going to talk a bit more about fibre. So limit your alcohol. Women should only have 1 to 2 drinks per day when they have a drink of alcohol, and that should only be on a few days per week. Some medical conditions and pregnancy, you'd be advised not to drink at all. Then physical activity, I would say, is probably the most important thing that you can do for your health. And the reason I say that is because it's been shown to be good for your mood, helps with weight control, it lowers blood pressure and cholesterol, it helps prevent diabetes, heart disease, breast cancer, and prevents falls. They recommend 30 minutes of physical activity most days of the week, and if you're trying to lose weight, then an hour on most days is needed for that. And we'll have Jamie talking more about this later. Then finally, mental health. So important things you can do to maintain your mental health are to have good relationships with other people, maintain and nurture those, have a strong spiritual life, grow in your faith in Christ, and aim to help and serve other people. Interestingly, this has been shown to increase your happiness by serving others, and that happens to be the way Jesus has asked us to live, and just shows how God really knows what's best for us. So just a few quick comments on what medications are safe to use over the counter. Not everything you can walk into a chemist shop and buy is necessarily going to be suitable for you. And people who need to be particularly cautious are the elderly, people with high blood pressure, and who have other underlying health problems. I would say the ones to be particularly wary of, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which can cause increased bleeding and increased heart disease and can elevate your blood pressure as well. That's things like Nurofen and aspirin. Low-dose aspirin is different. And then pseudoephedrine in nasal decongestants, such as Sudafed, can elevate your blood pressure. And codeine used for too long in too high a dose can cause problems as well. So these ones are, I would say, are safe for most people to use. The bottom line first is have a diagnosis. So if you don't know what's wrong with you, then it's not good to start treating something that you don't know. So see your doctor or discuss with the pharmacist if you're not sure. But for pain relief, paracetamol is safe, taken as directed. For allergies and hay fever, Telfast, a non-sedating antihistamine, is good. For stronger pain, short use of Panadeine with paracetamol and codeine is usually safe, such as for flu symptoms. Sore throat, lozenges are fine. Young women with period pain can generally take anti-inflammatories, such as naprogesic, which is naproxen, or ibuprofen, Nurofen. And fibre supplements for constipation, like psyllium, are fine. But if you've got a new onset of constipation, it's not getting better, see your doctor, because it could be something more sinister. Lubricating eye drops for dry eyes and nose sprays for a limited time are usually safe as well. So there's probably a few others, but basically if you're not sure what's wrong with you or it's something's persisting, see your doctor.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Yes, thank you. So I've got a couple of questions I've written down. So because the panel are just going to cover, you know, broad brushstrokes. So don't forget, just write some questions down and we'll have a chance to hopefully address those later on. So we might hear from Andrew. Thank you.
I'm going to jump down here.
Go for it. All right, while he's doing that, everybody stick your feet up and show us what shoes you're wearing today. No, joking. Oh, you've already looked. All right, you young girls, what are your heels like? Oh, very nice.
All right. Hello again. We're going to have a look at some shoes. We're going to have a look at some characteristics of shoes. There are going to be some generalizations in here because I don't know what your feet are like. I don't know what you're trying to do. I don't know what you're trying to achieve. So I'm just making it up as I go. Like Lynn just said, without a diagnosis, without knowing what your feet are doing, we can't really give you much advice. So some generalizations. Here we go. Who thinks that the young people today wearing those big stilettos are going to get themselves in trouble later on? Yep. Who thinks wearing thongs generally is not good for you and they should be avoided? Who here admits that they often wear shoes they shouldn't, they know they shouldn't, but they still choose to? Okay, and I see the younger crowd puts their hands up there. This is a very difficult thing in podiatry to work with because people are very attached to their shoes. Again, a generalisation. I had a lady come in to me, I can't remember the exact wording, but it went something like this. She came in, I said, what can I do for you today? First time I'd ever seen her. Initial consultation. There's something wrong with my feet. My feet are absolutely killing me. Anytime I go to Erin Affair, somewhere like that, I'm walking around, I can go about 20 minutes. After 20 minutes, my feet are really, really sore. I can't walk at all. And I'll say, okay, what shoes do you wear when you go up to Erin Affair? We start with the really obvious things. What shoes do you wear when you go up to Erin Affair? Do you wear these shoes? She says, yes, these are the only shoes really that I own. They're the only ones I ever wear. I said, all right, well, we'll start with those. We'll have a look at the shoes. She says, oh, no, it's not those shoes. They're really expensive and they're really comfortable. And I think, well, where does the consultation go from here? Your feet are really sore, but your shoes are really comfortable. So work with me and try not to rule out what I'm saying until you've heard. When we're looking at shoes, it's a bit like cars. I'll talk about cars because you need to pick the feature that's going to suit you. I like Toyotas, but I can't just go down to the Toyota shop and buy a random Toyota because they make little two-door Yaris, great for commuting, cheap on fuel, and they also make Land Cruiser Utes. Now, if I'm a farmer feeding cows out, the small one is not going to work for me, even though it's a very good quality Toyota car. Similarly, if you commute to Sydney, you don't want the four-wheel drive Ute with all the road noise and the cost. So shoes are the same. Don't worry about the brand. You need to think about the characteristics. And the second thing is the price. Price will affect some things, like the quality of the make, maybe made in Australia, some things you like to support. But in terms of the comfort, the cost doesn't necessarily mean a more comfortable shoe. People come and ask me about shoes, and if they have no pain, it's very, very hard for me to give an answer. If you're comfortable in what you're wearing and you can do all the activities that you want to do, generally you can keep doing it. If you have problems, though, that's when we start to address it. Let's look at thongs quickly. They've got a very bad name, but if a 45-year-old comes in to see me, a 45-year-old surfer, and he lives with them all day, I'm not going to be the one to tell him not to wear them because he's not going to listen. But if you come in with foot pain, like that lady, and she wasn't wearing thongs this day, but if she came in with thongs, we'd try and get rid of them. We need to look at characteristics. This particular thong has no arch support at all. It's very flat. You'll notice the rear foot height is the same as the forefoot height. So there are certain injuries that this can cause. There's also certain injuries that this can help. But there's certain injuries this can cause. If we change a few of those characteristics... I should have unclipped this earlier.
Do you want us to do it?
Do it one-handed. This thong is made with a couple of other characteristics. It now has a 10mm elevator in the rear foot, which takes a bit of strain off the Achilles tendon and off the muscles in the back of the foot. It also has some arch support. So you can wear thongs if you select good characteristics. This shoe here is designed for people who have... it's actually been taken off the market because what it was designed for, it wasn't doing. But it does have some characteristics we like. This one has a rocker sole in it. It has a curve at the back, also a curve at the front. So this is good for people with arthritis in the ankle joint, particularly if you have anterior pinching in your ankle. This shoe will help you to propel forward without putting as much pressure on your ankle. Also, forefoot pain. Sesamoid injuries, hallux rigidus or some arthritis around your first MPJ, that's your big toe joint. Bunions, this can help you to propel forward. So if people come in with that, that's the sort of thing that I'll point them towards. Ignoring brand, ignoring price. Find something that has a small rocker sole in the front, probably not quite as big as this. This is quite pronounced. But that sort of feature can help. This shoe, however, would be bad for some people. If I have an older patient with poor balance, I'm going to be very hesitant to give them this one because if they start to roll over backwards, this shoe's going to send them over. Same with going forwards. You suddenly lose your brakes in this one. If you get a bit of a downhill, you can find you're walking very, very quickly by the bottom. So it's about weighing up the characteristic of a shoe with what you need and what you require and what you're capable of. Fashion is one of the things we have to try and incorporate into our characteristics. This is a summer shoe that can be used with orthotics or insoles if you need that. It has characteristics of a removable insole, closed-in heel counter, and a little bit of a rocker sole underneath there. How about this cracker? Don't wear many of these. I do. These are a terrific shoe. They have a purpose. They actually can be good for multiple different types of foot pain. They're very soft. They're very flexible in the right places. If you're involved in any sort of water sports, they're terrific. They float. So if you go fishing, they keep the oysters away from your feet when you're at the boat ramp. They don't meet all the fashion criteria. And my wife hates the fact that I am one of these. But there is a place for them. The downside, there's also some people who shouldn't wear them. They don't hold on to your foot particularly well. So if you have a long, skinny, narrow foot, you can be in trouble. They're quite broad. And we have had incidences where when people are walking, older people with poor balance in particular, if you bang your feet together with these on, they kind of catch. So if you check your heels as you're walking, they can be quite a trip hazard. But there is a place for them in water sports. And then we have some fairly safe walking shoes. These have got a good supportive heel counter. They've got lace-up fastenings to keep your foot comfortable. Generally good quality walking shoes. There's another one here, similar. That's the body shoe. Even these good shoes, though, can cause particular discomfort. If you have a lot of midfoot arthritis or pain through the middle of your foot, sometimes you can get little bumps on top of the bones when the arthritis gets bad enough. This lacing pattern, the shoes are good, but the laces can really upset you. So we may need to find a shoe that has a different fastening strap, whether it's a higher Velcro strap, a lower Velcro strap, or we can adjust the laces, the lacing pattern themselves. So you might cross over the bottom three holes and then go up the side a little bit and just do one or two crosses at the top, and that'll take all the pressure off the midfoot. So have a think about your own feet. I haven't answered all the questions because we don't know what you're looking for in a shoe. If you're pain-free and you're comfortable, as long as your shoe doesn't look like this, you're probably okay and you can keep wearing what you're wearing. If, however, you're getting discomfort in a particular place, try out all your shoes at home because you may already have something in there that meets the criteria and that makes you comfortable. If you find a shoe that is consistently uncomfortable, and actually write it down. Every time you get a sore foot, what have I done today? which shoes were I wearing? And you'll probably find a bit of a pattern. And you need to listen to your body in that case. You need to stop wearing that shoe and work out why that pain is there. The last thing we might talk about is barefoot. We need to try and avoid, in a lot of cases, again, a generalisation, but we need to try and avoid barefoot, particularly around the house. We're in a society now that has hard concrete floors, hard timber floors, hard tile floors. Our feet really can't tolerate that pressure for extended periods. So it is advisable to wear a shoe of some sort, even thongs, which we've already said can be good, can be bad, are generally better than going barefoot. Have a think about it. You know what's good for you and you know what's not. If you have a particular pain, try and find out what it is, see the appropriate people, and we'll see if we can use footwear as the initial tool to try and get you more comfortable. All right? Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. So the question is, how many of us have got those cream shoes? Well, we don't have to put our hands up. So, all right, over to you, Jamie.
That was great, wasn't it? Okay, so yeah, look, my journey in the fitness industry did start when I was 19, and turning 29 this year, I've seen my fair share of fitness fads come and go. The fitness industry is just constantly changing, and I reckon you guys know what I'm talking about because you've seen the ads from the Randy Couture's, you've got a door, you've got a gym, to the Abswing Pro ads, you know what I'm talking about. It's funny, I always see the Abswing Pros on the side of the road for council pickup. And it's funny, my dad, who needs to lose weight, just loves his Abswing Pro and still holds onto it but never uses it. And what about all the diet trends as well? So I've got a long list here from the Kim Kardashian diet to the Lemon Detox diet, Atkins, Dukan, Paleo, P90X, Light and Easy, Weight Watchers, Tony Ferguson, Celebrity Slim, Michelle Bridges, 12-Week Challenge. The list goes on. There's so many fads and trends that come and go. And often these trends are just a big hit worldwide and then put to bed within years because either something new or better hits the shelves or new research comes out suggesting that the practice isn't actually as beneficial as first thought. But that's just the fitness industry. And over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been three consistent thoughts and principles that have just stood the test of time. And that's what we want to share with you today. We call them at Mingara, that's our fitness philosophy, we call them the Big Three. So today we want to share with you what the Big Three is. In my mind, when it comes to health and fitness, we need to stop making things so complicated and we need to get back to basics, which is just the Big Three. So here's the recipe for success. The Big Three, the foundation of this Big Three pyramid. Eat well. We've already talked about it.
Pens poised. Look at them.
We've already talked about it a little bit, and Teresa is our expert when it comes to talking all things nutrition, and she's going to talk about that today. She's going to talk a little bit about what it looks like to eat well, but that would be the king of the Big Three, to eat well. The next one, which I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about, is move a lot. What's move a lot? And for those of you that want to get the most out of your exercise today, we might have an opportunity in some question time to show you through some exercises that you could potentially do at home in your living room that might take less than 5 minutes. That would be really cool for you guys to be doing a couple of times a week. And the third element to the Big Three is sleep enough. That's simple, but that's a big one. And we'll talk a little bit about that too, and there might be some question time on that as well. But there's the Big Three. There you go. Eat well, move a lot. Sleep enough. Pretty simple, huh? And for many people looking for a quick fix, it almost seems boring, but in my mind, that's the recipe for success. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time today just talking about the Big Three, and particularly move a lot. That's my role. So I'm flying the flag as the personal trainer today. I don't actually work as a personal trainer anymore. My role's changed a little bit, but it's my passion. It's my hobby. I love it. And I'm excited today to talk a little bit about move a lot. Firstly, I'm just going to say that's exactly what we're recommending, move a lot. And for you to do that, it's important to find something you enjoy doing. So I was chatting to Lynn just before over brekkie. She said she actually invited my parents over for tennis today. And my dad's got a bad hip at the moment, so obviously they're not doing that. But that's fantastic. So Lynn, I know Lynn and Phil enjoy tennis. Great. Keep doing that. It might be walking on the beach It might be swimming. It might be team sports. It could be anything. But we want to encourage you to move more. Again, for those of you, I think that's helpful because we don't want to view exercise as a chore. A lot of people see exercise as a luxury, whereas in fact it's not. It's necessary for all of us, and there's a lot of benefits attached to exercise. So it's important to find something we enjoy doing. But for those that do want to get the most out of their exercise, I've kind of got three quick tips that I'll run through before I pass on to Teresa. Those tips are, if you want to get the most from your exercise, here we go, three tips. First one, constantly varied. It's important to mix up what we do when it comes to exercise. Your body is really smart and gets really used to what you do if you do it all the time. So it is important to mix it up. I enjoy this for me personally because it keeps things fresh and it's easy to get stale doing the same thing. It is really cool when it comes to exercise to keep your body guessing. So constantly varied training or exercise is really important. And that might mean if you like walking on the beach, instead of walking the same distance all the time, you might even do a shorter walk, but try and walk a little faster. Or you might do some, from this bin to that bin, I'll walk faster, then I'll walk slow. Or I might do soft sand, or I might do a hill today. Or just mixing it up is important. And you can do that lots of different ways. And I enjoy that because it allows you to get creative and have a bit of fun with your workouts and your exercise. And it's a great way to keep your body guessing, meaning you're going to get best training adaptations, meaning best results. The second tip, high intensity is important. I call this one the magic. At Mingara, we've got about 5,000 gym members. And again, being there a long time, sad to say, I reckon probably 90% of them don't get results. And I reckon this has got a lot to do with it. So when they do train, often they're not training at the right intensity. So intensity can be really important. And when I say intensity, that's relative to you and your goals. And so we do want to, basically high intensity means the heart rate's got to go north. We want to get the heart rate up, but that's, again, specific to you. And the third tip, I love talking about this one, is functional movement. We want to be training in a way that allows us to develop this fitness and this strength that will translate really well into everyday life, into the real world. So I'm pretty passionate about squats. Kim said she's staying away from me today because she thinks I'll make her squat. I won't make you squat today. If you'd like to, you can do that with me. But I believe this loss of ability to squat is what puts people in nursing homes. This is a functional movement. We do it every day. You're about to do it when you jump up out of your chair. We need to keep these movements that we do in the real world. We need to keep these movements happening. We need to keep strong. We need to keep functionally fit. So I'm a big fan of training for how we move in everyday life. And we can talk a bit more about that a bit later on too. So that's pretty much all I wanted to touch on. I do have a couple of movements I wouldn't mind showing you later on. I think we might get a bit of time for that later. But for now, I'll keep things moving and I'm going to pass you on to my colleague, Teresa.
Hi, everyone. So like Jamie said, we have our principle, which is the big three, and we believe at Mingara that eating well is the foundation of a healthy lifestyle. So basically, my job is to coach people, to educate people, to get people thinking about what it is that my body actually needs and what can I be doing on a daily basis to either maintain or improve my overall health. So I'm quite passionate about food. I love food. And I think it's really important that you develop a good relationship, a healthy relationship with food. So how many of you out there have actually been on a diet, tried a diet, is currently on a diet? Yes? Come on, hands up. Hands up. Maybe you've tried one. Maybe you've tried several of the diets that Jamie's read out, Weight Watchers, Ashy Binds, all those kinds of fitness fads and trends. Any of those diets will work as long as you stick to them. But that's the issue. A lot of people, they're not consistent with what they do, particularly with their nutrition. But we don't want to just be doing those Ashy Binds and, you know, those Weight Watchers type diets if they don't meet three key elements. One, they need to be sustainable. You need to be able to do this day in and day out for the rest of your life. And if you're looking at one of those particular diets, I guarantee you, you won't be able to because they're restrictive. You either have to cut whole food groups out. You either have to eat too much of something, you have to think a particular way, do something in particular that you're not really used to doing, and that's probably not natural for you. That goes against everything that you kind of know that your body should or shouldn't be doing. The second thing is that you need to keep it balanced. So Lynn touched on the core food groups, the healthy eating pyramid. That hadn't been updated for about 15 years. So even coming just back to basic healthy eating, nothing's really changed. We need to make sure that we are getting a variety of those core food groups. There are some things we need more of, there are some things we need less of, and that's because each different food group provides us with different nutrients. And as we go through different life stages, those requirements change. So again, without knowing you personally, I can't say you need this amount of that and you need this amount of that, which is why no one diet will work for everyone, because we are all different. I could say to the two people sitting right in the front that you need this amount of calcium and you need this amount of calcium, but it doesn't mean that you're going to absorb exactly the same amount of calcium from your food, or that you need to eat the same amount in order to get that, because you're two very different people. So it's really important to keep in mind that you as the individual need to look at what does my body need, not what does anyone else's body need or what other people are doing, diets, fitness, workouts, etc., but what do I need for me? The third thing is it needs to be enjoyable. If you're not enjoying it, what's the point in doing it? Really? If it's not something that you can wake up every morning and go, oh, so looking forward to breakfast, I'm going to be having, you know, X, Y, and Z. Or like this morning I walked into the room and I was like, man, that food looks great. That table looks awesome. Not, oh my God, I can't have that because that's got carbs in it. Oh my God, that cream is full fat. No. Oh my God, there's pancakes. No, I can't really be having that because it's not Sunday, it's not brunch day. I looked at it and I went, wow, that is great. There's so many people together in one space enjoying and appreciating food for what it is and nourishing our bodies. So those three things, sustainable, balanced and enjoyable for you as an individual, is what's going to help to keep you healthy so you're not going to get sick. If you are sick, it's going to make you healthy. So I believe that eating well is the absolute foundation to a healthy lifestyle. It's going to prevent us from getting diabetes, from getting heart disease, from being overweight, from all those comorbidities which just stack up one on top of another so quickly that it almost just happens overnight. But if you're at that stage, it's still possible to go back the other way. I've known so many people who have come to see me and they've been doing, you know, personal training for 2 years and they're still at the same weight or they're still at the same body composition. They're going, I'm just not shifting. Have you looked at your diet? Have you looked at changing just a couple of little things? Not going on a diet. Have you looked at changing your diet to a healthier, sustainable, more balanced, more enjoyable way of life? Oh, no, not really. And as soon as that happens, things start to work again. And probably on, like, before even those three things, the mindset, so you were talking a little bit about mood before, if it's not up here first, it's not going to manifest here physically. So our thoughts are what predate everything that we do. So our physical body is a manifestation of our thoughts. So if you're unhappy with yourself, if you're constantly thinking about the guilt that's associated around food, I shouldn't be doing this or I should be doing that, and not thinking about things in a positive way, then those things are going to manifest physically. So I guarantee you, once you shift that thought process, that mindset around food to a more positive outlook, you know what, I'm going to try and get my two serves of fruit in today. I'm going to try and get that extra serve of veg. I'm going to maybe try and, you know, put some more salad on my multigrain wrap today. I'm going to put a little bit of extra veg with my dinner and maybe take out a little bit of the pasta. So just making those few healthier swaps is going to get you to that place, that goal of being healthy, but ultimately being happy. For me, like, health is being happy. It's being vibrant. It's being able to do what you want to do. It's being happy with yourself mentally and physically. So whilst for a lot of females, physically we want to look good, and that's the aesthetic appeal, but mentally on the inside, we're still not happy, which is why we go and we try different diets and we do different things and we feel bad if we, you know, derail off that path and then we stop doing it. So I'm just going to leave you with one other quick thought. going back to the car analogy, it's a really good analogy. Like, you can use the car for lots of different things. Like, you know, to fuel your body, you put good petrol in the car, and, you know, you don't want to put the crappy stuff in because otherwise your body's not going to function, you know, properly. But if we come back to the car analogy, let's just say I want you to picture yourselves. You're driving along the freeway. All of a sudden, you get a flat tire. What do? Someone, anyone. What do? You get a flat tire on the side of the road. Stop. Someone said stop. So you stop, you pull over to the side of the road. So we just need to take a break. We just need to analyse the situation. Then what do? Call the NRMA. So if you can't fix the tyre yourself, then we might call for help. Someone comes along, they give us a helping hand, they give us a little bit of, you know, support, motivation, get started again. So they fix the tyre. What do we then? Start again. Get back on the road heading in the same direction. Yes? Yeah. So heading in the same direction. So you can use this analogy for diets. A lot of people, they start a particular journey, a particular diet, and something happens and it derails them. So you get this flat tire and they go, man, that's it. I'm just not even going to bother. I'm going to slash the other three tires on my car. And I'm going to get out of the car and I'm going to walk back the direction I came. I don't even care where I'm going to anymore because I've got four flat tyres now and that's just useless. I'm going to have to get my car towed. So if you are on a particular journey with your food, you've got to keep going in the same direction. You will get there. But if you decide to slash the other three tyres on your car, that's your fault. So I really encourage you to find a way that works for you and to make sure that it's healthy, it's balanced, sustainable and enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. That's I think the balance, that's the big word, isn't it? And, yeah, that's what we look for everything. Jason, before, don't forget, if you've got some questions, I've got about 8 here. So if you don't want all of my questions to be asked, write some questions down and... we'll do after Jason's shared. Thanks.
Great. Thanks. All right. Well, I just thought it'd be helpful to reflect again before starting that, again, physical activity, exercise, keeping your body moving is a great thing. It's a good thing. But it made me think this week, again, just as I've been reading through the Bible, that the Apostle Paul writes to his understudy, Timothy, and he writes to him and he says in chapter 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8, he says, for physical training is of some value. It's good, it's great, but godliness has value for all things, holding promise for both this life and the life to come. And so exercise is great, physical training is great, but knowing the God of the universe, I reckon that's the best thing that we could do. But in saying that, like any good relationship, I've been asked to talk today on... how do I decide whether to go to the physio or the doctor if I've got muscular pain? But I thought I'd just get a show of hands. Who's had back pain in the past? Yep. That's us all. I'm in my third decade and, struggling with a lot of back pain, shoulder pain, looking forward to the life to come. But like any good relationship, ultimately we want one that's built on trust. And so whether I go to the physio, whether I go to the doctor, if I've got muscular pain, it's one that's built on trust. You want to find a good doctor, someone you can trust. You want to find a good physiotherapist that you can trust, that's going to give you the right advice, it's going to give you the right treatment. Most private practice physiotherapists will deal commonly with musculoskeletal pain, nerve-related pain, which tends to impact on day-to-day activities and quality of life. Physiotherapists work in a range of different contexts, with the majority of them working in hospitals, private practices. Often they'll go on to specialise in a particular area, like women's health, or they'll work with professional sporting clubs. They'll work in equine, so you get physios that work with animals and horses. So there's a whole lot, bunch of different areas. But I think one thing you want to ask, and I think one thing that people do want to know regarding pain itself, is I want to know three things. I want to know what's wrong. So as Andrew picked up and Lynn picked up earlier, they want a clear diagnosis. They want to be reassured, so people want to know that it's not serious. And thirdly, people want to be relieved of their pain, and they want to be given a clear treatment plan. So they want to know, what can I do? How can I self-manage? And so part of what I try to do as a physiotherapist is not come and see me next week, come and see me twice for the next 6 months, but we actually want to try and give people self-management strategies to take ownership, to take hold of their own pain and discomfort so that they can long-term care for themselves as best as they can physically. We know that early diagnosis and treatment often results in improved recovery. We know that within the workers' compensation realm, the sports realm, so you roll your ankle, you can be your own physio for the first few days. You can ice, you can rest, you can compress, you can get it elevated. You've got some back pain, you can whack a heat pack on there. You can get some Voltaren, you can rub that in. So you can be your own physio for the first little while, but if the pain persists, then sure, come and see us. In terms of going to the doctor, whether you go to the doctor or whether you come to the physio, I think there's a few questions you could ask regarding your pain. The first thing would be, and physiotherapists screen people. So if you come and see a physio as a primary care practitioner, we'll often ask screening questions to then send you back to your doctor. So that may be something like an unknown cause to your pain. It may be uncontrollable pain requiring medication. It may be acute trauma or fracture requiring a specific image that only a doctor can refer for. It may be suspicious pain that won't settle, so like unrelenting night pain, a family history of malignancy or unexplained weight loss, fever or infection. It's usually two ends of the spectrum, so usually people under the age of 20 who present with acute pain, or people over the age of 55. Around 2-4% of people with back pain will have, over the age of 55, will have some kind of stress-related fracture, so that's worth screening for. Back pain's common, so 90% of Australians will have at least one episode of back pain in their life. It can be treated quite early with some self-management strategies. Around 5% of people will have nerve-related pain, and about 1 in 100 people will have things like malignancy or a fracture, those kinds of things. So, yeah, I guess the thing is, if you're unsure, yeah, you could come and see your doctor. You could go and see the physio, and they can certainly point you in the right direction. But again, usually looking for most people, heat, usually for more chronic type pains, helpful. Usually ice for more acute episodes. There's the kind of two ends of the spectrum. That's regarding pain. I've been asked to talk a little bit about bladder issues. Now, I absolutely have no idea about bladder issues.
Don't feel you have to. That was just because there's a whole lot of women's bladders.
I just want to own that.
But give us your professional background.
Sure. So I'll give her a little plug here. She's only new to the coast, but Melinda Sandon's just moved to the Central Coast. Her husband's just come on staff here. Now, she's great. So I go and see her. She's a women's health physiotherapist. She's trained in this kind of area. So I'll give you the broad brush strokes, and then you can go and see her. She'll help you out. The signs of poor and weak bladder or urinary incontinence, there's usually three types. So there's urge incontinence, which is due to an overactive or an unstable bladder. There's overflow, which is due to a bladder that's too full because it hasn't emptied properly. And the most common is stress incontinence, which occurs due to an increase in intra-abdominal pressure, which usually occurs during coughing or sneezing, laughing, or lifting. The signs of a poor or weak bladder, again, are accidental loss of urine from the bladder, frequency, so wanting to urinate too often, nocturia, so having to get up at least twice a night to go to the toilet, or urgency, so that is sudden urges to urinate. In terms of management, it can be managed quite easily. Most people with a good management plan can certainly get their incontinence under control. So that
usually firstly includes medication. So I'm sure Lynn could speak more into this, but anticholinergic medications, medications particularly that can, mainly for an overactive bladder, can certainly help settle an overactive bladder. Pelvic floor retraining. So one helpful exercise that you could try is sitting on the toilet and just trying to, like, first of all, the first stage is identifying those muscles. So muscles around your urethra, the front and back. So trying to stop yourself going to the toilet midstream. So that's probably one helpful way of just starting to develop some bladder control. And the second stage would be, just in a sitting or a standing position, trying to gently draw your pelvic floor up towards your belly button, trying to hold that for 10 seconds at a time and then relaxing. You could try that up to 4 or 5 times a day. And then once you're getting the hang of that, you could then drop back to then going to the toilet, trying to stop yourself midstream. There's a helpful way of simplifying some pelvic floor retraining. In terms of self-care, limiting caffeine and alcohol, that can often irritate your bladder. Medications, fruit, vegetables, grain foods, regular exercise, 30 minutes of moderate activity per day. Apparently, my wife was telling me there's some eligibility for government subsidy for some people to reduce the cost of things like incontinence pads and AIDS. A couple of helpful websites if you're writing things down, continence.org.au and pelvicfloorfirst.org.au. Just giving them a plug.
Yeah. Okay, there is quite a range of questions. They're all coming back, yep. And if you think of some others, yeah, just throw them up. Thanks, Kim. And we'll try and go through them as quickly as we can. For you, Lynn, there's a couple, so I'll throw them all at you. two questions about pap smears. Are pap smears going to be replaced by a vaginal swab? And if you're not sexually active, do you need a pap smear? So just go with those first.
The easy one is if you're not sexually active, you don't, and have never been sexually active, you don't need a pap smear. The reason is that they think that's the human papillomavirus or wart virus. Genital warts is the condition that causes, is the trigger for developing cervical cancer. So if you haven't had sexual activity where you've been at risk of picking up the virus, then you shouldn't, by most accounts, develop cervical cancer. So that's that one. That's why we say 2 years after you start sexual activity, then you should start getting a pap smear. Then they are going to replace, I think it might be 2016 or 17, the pap smears. They're going to introduce the screen for that very virus, the HPV virus, and if you've got that, you need more frequent pap smears, and if you don't have that, you need less frequent pap smears. And I think it'll drop to 5 yearly pap smears.
Oh, wow, that's when great. That, so when is that coming in again? Sorry?
I'm not sure if it's 2016 or 17, okay. But it's coming, and they'll use liquid cytology as well instead of just on the slide. And so that'll differentiate people. Self-collection, I think they're still looking at. I think people think that may not be trustworthy.
Viable. No. Okay, great. All right, one probably for, or there's a couple, and it's probably for everybody to have a bit of a go at. There's several questions about weight loss and central weight. How, even though one person, even though they're doing the right thing, they're having trouble getting rid of their central weight. Is there an easy way to get rid of your central weight? Can we just, you know, with all
can
the...
Can I start off?
Go for it, Teresa.
Okay, so central adipose tissue, or the fat that surrounds our midsection, responds really well to dietary change. Just throwing it out there. So... even in as little as, say, 2 to 4 weeks, you can actually see change within the adipose tissue that sits around your organs. So usually that responds well to reducing or eliminating added sugars in the diet. So I'm not talking about natural sugars from, like, fruits and vegetables and dairy. I'm talking about added sugars. So things which are, like, added into, like, cereals, biscuits, pastries, takeaway foods, etc. So if you are able to reduce that added sugar in your diet and focus on reducing your overall portion sizes, so they're two things that will help to reduce that adipose tissue around your midsection.
Now, there's been a lot of talk. There's a lot of hidden sugars in foods mm-hmm. that we buy. Could you just give the ladies sort of what foods should they be really careful of that have got a lot of hidden added sugar?
So there's a lot of sugar. Pretty much in about 80% of the food products that are in the supermarket, there's added sugar. So the supermarkets probably wouldn't be very big if we weren't adding sugar into our food products. So cereal is one. So when you're trying to choose a cereal, you're trying to look for something that says whole grain or is based off whole grain. So a great example would be oats. They're basically just low GI carbohydrate, no sugar, really high in fibre. Again, if you're looking at purchasing a cereal, look for something that does have quite a bit of fibre in it, because fibre is that indigestible part of a plant that we don't absorb into our bodies. So it just helps promote good bowel health like for our bodies as well. So, diet yogurts would be another one. So don't pick anything that says diet, low fat. Marshmallows are 99% fat free. That means they're 99% sugar. So it doesn't make it better for you. So please really have a look at the label on the back of the packet. Don't be fooled by consumer front of label packaging. We do have a new Health Star rating system, which rates food based on their total energy, total sugar, total fat, sodium as well. But you need to have a look at the back of your packet. There's a nutrition panel on there, and then there's an ingredients list underneath it. If it lists sugar in, say, the top three or four ingredients, it's added sugar. So if it comes from something like an example of fruit, so like if it says fruit or sultanas, it's fruit sugar. But if it says sugar, glucose, honey, syrup, molasses, anything that ends in ose, basically, OSE, is added sugar. So cereals, diet yogurts would be one. I don't need to talk about the confectionery aisle because we know that there's sugar in the confectionery aisle, so chocolates, lollies, etc. But seemingly healthy-type foods may not be so healthy, so please read your label on the back of your packet.
Thank you. What about the moving boys? Anything you have to add about central weight?
Yeah, I was just going to say big three. So we've talked about eat well, move a lot, sleep enough, recipe for success, and don't underestimate the importance of sleep. We've got this hormone called cortisol. It's a stress hormone. There's lots of ways we can get high cortisol, but poor sleep is one of those ways. And we've got this little stress hormone kicking around our body. It can make weight loss really hard. So quality sleep, meaning getting good length, pitch black. It's got a bit to do with photo exposure. Your red blood cells can detect artificial light. So making sure that the room's blacked out, getting long sleep, all these little things can really help. But diet's the big one. Diet's the big one. So making sure we're getting those three macronutrients, carbohydrates, protein, and fat, and eating foods that our body is designed to eat. Again, if you have more questions on that, we're going to stick around a little bit after. Teresa can talk all day about that and loves it. So come have a chat to either her or myself about food. What do you think, Jace? You got anything down there?
Yeah. So there's two predominant types of fat in the body. There's intra-abdominal fat, which is the kind of fat that sits around the body's organs itself. And so that tends to be the most dangerous kind of fat in terms of increasing your risk of stroke, cancer, cardiovascular disease, so on and so forth. And then the subcutaneous fat, which is kind of just sits below the level of the skin. Generally speaking, in terms of spot reduction, it's a little bit like me saying, if I just keep moving my pinky all day, will my pinky get thinner? If I keep moving my stomach all day, will I spot reduce my stomach? There's no evidence in any kind of medical literature that spot reducing happens. You just get your body moving, and wherever you're carrying the weight the most, that's where you'll lose it from. In terms of girth measurements, generally speaking, for men, 102 centimetres for women, 92 centimetres. For women, roughly 80 centimetres. There and above, usually your risk is increased. It's greatly increased for men over 102 centimetres, and I think women roughly, I think it's
88 centimetres, yeah. So that significantly increases your risk of heart disease from there. In terms of exercising at an intensity that's helpful, you can calculate your heart rate or the range that your heart rate you can work in. So generally 60 to 80% of your heart rate's a good place to kind of work for 30 minutes to 45 minutes on most days. You can calculate that by just getting your resting heart rate, 220 minus your age, and then times that by 0.6.
Hang on a minute, slow that down. Have you got it? Because I've missed it. Right. So
sure. So you
sounds really good.
You can Google it. So it's called Carvonin, method of calculating Carvonin. So 220 minus your age. You've got to work out what your resting heart rate is. So you can do that by just taking your pulse. Resting heart rate is in a minute. So 220 minus your age, minus your resting heart rate, times 0.6.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Plus, where do I plus, get? Plus, add your resting heart rate again. So 220 minus your age. Got that?
Yeah, we had to slow it down,
minus,
didn't we, girls?
Minus your resting heart rate times 0.6 plus your resting heart rate. That'll give you 60% of your maximum heart rate. And then 80%, you'd naturally just do the same except substitute 0.6 for 0.8. And that's... Yeah, and that's the range. Yeah. So there you go. So if you wear a heart rate monitor and you walk with a heart rate monitor, great, I'm working in the zone.
Yeah.
Or you can, at the end of a walk or exercise, you can simply just take your resting heart rate. That's a helpful way of working out, am I working hard enough or am I working too hard? Mm. That gives you a picture between 60 to 80% of your maximum heart rate. Mm. That's a helpful way.
And that's helpful. I think, Jamie, you were saying get the impact, high impact. If we're not raising our heartbeat, our heart rate, we're not going to get the
high intensity. We call that one
high intensity.
The magic. High intensity is the magic. So that's just what Jay said. The heart rate's got to go north. And to get best results, that just flips the fat-burning switches. And there's a real place, too, for lower intensity, longer duration exercise as well. But getting the heart rate high, whether it's through steady straight or interval style training, lots of different ways you can do it, but high intensity is the magic, getting the heart rate up.
Good. There was a question about calluses on our feet and perhaps a suggestion of where we could go to get good footwear. Can you help us with that, Andrew?
Yeah, we did. We got that question. We'll start with the shoe one because it's very difficult. As I said, you can't go to get good shoes unless you know what good shoes are. So those blue Crocs that I had, the very fashionable ones, I picked them up in a little centre stall at Erin Affair for $2.95.
Are they real Crocs for $2.95? No.
The Croc sticker fell off in the first 2 days.
Oh, okay.
So I have some suspicions, but they're just as comfortable as Crocs, which then again reflects on the money you need to spend. If you think you have trouble feet that are difficult to fit, there's a very good store at Wyoming. They used to be called Comfort and Fit. They have now changed to Heel to Toe. But Athlete's Foot will tell you they're the best at fitting running shoes and joggers. Rebel Sports will try and tell you the same thing. And everybody has the best prices. So it's just a matter of you working out what you need and then trying to have a look and find the shop that provides it. Many good shoes for different foot types at Payless Shoes, Rivers, Cheap as Chips. It's about the characteristics that you need and where you can find that. Second question I got was about calluses on your feet and how I can get rid of them. Calluses are just hard skin, and it's a response to pressure. There are other reasons you can get thickened skin, dry thickening of the skin, but calluses in particular are pressure. So if you imagine a council worker, he's on a shovel all day, he's going to get calluses on his hands. Now, if that council worker thinks that's a problem and goes home every night and buys a pet egg off the television and shaves that away, it's kind of a waste of time. So we need to work out when do calluses actually become a problem, and as well as how do we get rid of them, which was what the question was. What's causing them and what can we do to change that? And that really depends on whereabouts on your foot the callus is. It's one of the best diagnostic tools we have. If somebody comes in and they're telling me a story about what they think is wrong and they take their shoes off, if I can see certain callus patterns straight away, I know the way this foot functions, I know where the restrictions are, and I know what we might be trying to treat. Even if it's not the callus, they're in because they have rear foot pain or heel pain or ankle pain. Seeing the callus pattern around their forefoot and around their toes and which toes have it lets me know what's happening at the rear foot. So I can then treat the rear foot not looking at the callus at all. But if the callus is the problem and that's what we want to address, we need to try and work out why it's happening and where it's happening. So one example, if you imagine this is your big toe, this is the pad on the ball of your foot, obviously. If you get callus up underneath here, which we call your IPJ, it's usually an indication of some arthritic problem or some joint restriction back at the big joint here in the ball of your foot. You understand that one? Up on the bottom of your toe shouldn't be a heavily weight-bearing area. And if it is, it's usually because this joint further back is not doing its job. So as well as treating the callus, which I'll touch on in a second, we want to treat the cause. And that's when we look at the shoe characteristics. Remember that big, ugly, white rocker sole? You don't need a big, ugly, white shoe. What you need is a shoe that just has a little bit of that rocker sole component. So that as you start to roll forward and start to lift your heel off the ground, we call that heel lift, it's very technical, that's when you start to load up your big toe and put that pressure there. But if you have a small rocker sole component in your footwear, it will enable you to propel naturally. Once again, you've got to remember your brakes on the downhills because it helps you to propel. But that's the way to treat your callus on your foot. If we actually get a little rocker sole, we enable that first MPJ joint. Well, we're not actually making it work better, but we're preventing its problems affecting other parts of the toe. You propel a little bit better, the callus will settle down. To treat the callus itself, as I said, it's just a build-up of dead skin, so we simply shave it away. We don't want to take too much away. It's just like having a haircut or having your toenails trimmed. It doesn't hurt. The pet eggs on television, you see that lovely foot model. She's about 22 and there's nothing wrong with her foot, but she's telling you you need to shave it all. I don't like those because people do it too much. They get excited. And remember that callus is there for a reason. This joint's not working, so your body is deliberately putting callus on this joint because it's a high-pressure area. You don't want to go home, sit in front of the Bold and the Beautiful or whatever shows we watch and shave that back to bare skin because you're going to create a problem. So I try and avoid the pet eggs. Stay away from them. If it is an ongoing issue for you, go and see somebody to work out why it's happening. It can be dermatological conditions. It can just be that you naturally have dry skin. It can be biomechanical issues like I spoke about. What we want to do, though, is moisturise, and this is something I forgot to mention earlier. Mary asked in this talk, could I mention what are the simplest things to do to look after your feet? And it's probably choose your shoes wisely and moisturise regularly. There's lots and lots of reasons you do this, and one of them is for this callus. Think back to the council worker with the dry, hard hands. He needs some padding there because he's on a shovel all day. Rather than cutting that away, moisturising cream, get that callus soft and mobile. It's still there, but it's comfortable, it's soft, and it's mobile because it's serving a purpose. All right, so regular moisturising. Other reasons we want to do this, I'm going off topic now, but other reasons we moisturise. One is to get in a habit of touching and looking at your feet. This is terrific if you have diabetes, something like that. One of the many foot-related complications of diabetes can be peripheral neuropathy, which is a decrease in sensation, not always completely numb feet, but a decrease in sensation. That's a very important thing in protecting yourself. So if I walk outside and I tread on a little rock and it happens to catch on my skin, I'll make sure after three or four steps that I scrape my foot to get it off. If I have a little pebble inside my shoe, if I walk out onto a road, I actually had this case when we were working up at the hospital on the ulcer clinic. A man had a couple of visitors around for lunch. It was middle of summer and the visitor left and he backed his car out onto the road. And then he thought of something quickly he had to tell him. So he ran out onto the road, ran to the driver's side window and spoke to this man for 10 minutes. What he didn't realise is it was a 35-degree day. That road was super hot. And so he basically stood on there for 10 minutes and slow-cooked his feet. So if you have diabetes, you have a risk of decreased sensation. You can't rely on just feeling any problems or pathologies that develop. So getting into this habit, even if your skin is already lovely and soft, touching your feet every day, giving them a feel, giving them a rub, enables you to pick up any problems or concerns that might come, whether that's a little skin spot, a little crack, a little rash, or callus. So moisturise your feet regularly. If you don't have any problems, you can use anything. Use the cheapest sorbolene you can get because it's all about the habit. If you do have callus, if you do have problems, there's better products. The ingredient that I like is urea. Now, the catch of this is that a lot of creams with urea in them are particularly thick and pasty and don't smell very good. They're made for a medical purpose. But if you can find one that has the urea in it and it still smells okay and it's easy to use, I'd go with that. All right?
Thanks, Andrew. And just while we've got you, there's a couple of questions. If you could just quickly mention walking on the beach barefoot, mm-hmm. and what about our children, young children, and I notice I have three grandsons and they love to be barefoot all the time. Is that a problem or just quickly?
Yeah, you'll get different views when you speak to different podiatrists. My point of view, no. My kids run around barefoot all the time in the backyard. There's a couple of hazards there, like our Kelpie dog, but generally speaking, it's a safe environment. It's good for the muscles in their feet. It's good to get them growing and getting those muscles working. Walking on the beach barefoot, if you have no problems and no foot pathologies, then it's terrific. It makes you work harder. And if you're healthy, working harder is good. It gets all those little muscles in your feet working. And in our society, again, we don't tend to do that because we have these perfectly symmetrical flat floors and everybody puts so much focus on good quality supportive shoes. So all the intrinsic foot muscles become very lazy. So it would be good to train them up and get mobile again, walking around on the beach, walking around on uneven surfaces. Now, the flip side of that is if we're starting to use muscles that haven't done any work and we're starting to make them work again, that's an injury risk. So it needs to be done carefully. That's like me asking some of the exercise guys and the trainers, should I do a 10K run? And the answer is, if I do lots of training and I build up to it, doing a 10K run every Saturday morning is terrific. But if I've not done anything before and I just say, oh, I heard on the grapevine that 10K runs are great, and I go hammer and tong down a concrete path, I need to expect to get injured. So it's all a balancing game. If you're fit and healthy, go on the beach, barefoot, enjoy it. It's really, really good for your muscles. If you have heel pain, plantar fasciitis, injuries like that, you probably want to stay off it. You want to have good shoes, supportive shoes with a bit of an inner sole. Maybe even stay off the concrete footpaths and find somewhere on the grass to walk around the park, around the oval, something like that. But if we can get you back to full health and comfort, barefoot on the beach is terrific again.
Great, that's great. Okay, just a couple of questions. There's quite a few questions about additives. Should I take vitamin B, fish oil, krill oil? And also there was a question for you, Lynn, when you said good oils, is coconut oil a good oil? Coconut oil. So if somebody would like to comment about food additives, yep.
So in relation to the supplements, I'll start with that. So. Yep. So with vitamin and mineral supplements, yes, some of them have been clinically proven, like fish oil, to be very good for our overall health, good for our brain health as well. So it's always good to obviously talk with your GP first, because if you're taking different medications, some things like fish oil can actually interact with warfarin, not on a huge scale. It's a very low interaction, but because they have similar properties, so warfarin being a blood thinner, and fish oil can also actually thin the blood to a very small degree. So even things which seem, you know, quite normal or quite harmless, you still need to get it checked with your GP just to make sure that there's no interactions there. In regards to do I need to be taking supplements? Supplements are supplements. They're in addition or in conjunction with a healthy diet. If you're taking supplements because you're not getting the right nutrition from your diet, then your diet is what you should need to be focusing on first. There are, however, different life stages which require supplementation. So one of them being, like, if you're planning on becoming pregnant or you are in the first trimester of pregnancy, folic acid or folate is an important supplement to take because it is actually proven to reduce neural tube defects. If you are at an older life stage, calcium, vitamin D, B12, they're all vitamins and minerals which we actually start to lack and reduce the ability to store in our body. So we actually need that higher intake of dairy. So for someone, say, below 50, we only need about 3 servings of dairy. For people above 50, we actually need closer to 4 because our calcium requirements go up because we start to have that bone loss as we get older. Iron supplementation as well. Some people are naturally just iron deficient or anemic, and that could be a genetic thing. Maybe you're a vegetarian and we need to take those supplements. But all those kind of weight loss, fat burning, over-the-counter pills, potions, concoctions, no, they don't work. They're probably actually more harmful for your overall health. So definitely have a chat about it with your GP or naturopath or nutritionist before you start taking all different kinds of vitamins and supplements.
So, Lynn, do you want to comment on that?
I'd like to make a comment about fish oil. It was thought that it does reduce the risk of heart disease because it improves your cholesterol profile and has good oils. But studies have shown that people taking fish oil, it hasn't reduced heart disease, but people eating fish has. So that's why I plug eat fish. That's the whole food seems to be better. It certainly has been shown to improve brain function and asthma, and giving it to children or making sure they're eating lots of fish is good for their development of their brain.
Absolutely.
And there's also a concern about what it's doing to the krill supply that the whales eat. So I think there's some concern about the trend to wholeheartedly go into fish oil, so eat fish. Then I would say just with iron, certainly some people do need to take iron, but I wouldn't be self-treating on that one. I'd be checking out with the doctor, seeing if you do need it, how long can you take it. You can overdose on iron.
Yep.
And certainly supplements, iodine is one in pregnancy that's important too, so pregnancy vitamins are really helpful for that. There's a few conditions they think might help with certain vitamin Bs. Skin cancer prevention, vitamin B3, one twice a day, has been shown to reduce skin cancer. So there's a few therapeutic things. People with macular degeneration might take Macuvision, which is a certain special combination of vitamins, can help, but it's not for everybody because it can cause problems in people who don't need it. So just got to be careful. Some things actually increase diseases that are vitamins. So you can't just go whole heartedly into anything.
Always good to get some good advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And while you're there, Lynn, just a couple of questions about over-the-counter.
Oh, you said about coconut oil.
Yes.
I think the jury's a bit out on coconut oil. I think it's probably not as bad as people thought. It might have some favourable properties, but I can't really say more than that.
Okay. A couple of other questions about over-the-counter medications. So Ventolin, would you like to make some comment about Ventolin? And before you finish, you mentioned non-steroidals. Nurofen has, in the last 10 years, come out and being used for everybody, for everything. Would you like to make a comment about that?
Yeah. Well, Nurofen, I think, in children is a really good medication because they have very low side effects. But the older you get, I think the more risk of side effects you have, because it's, being a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, the risk of stomach ulceration, gastritis, increases the risk of bleeding, especially if you're on an antidepressant. And also it can elevate blood pressure and increase risk of heart disease, people on regularly. So I would just be cautious about these medications. They're not safe for everybody. And Nurofen Plus, I hate Nurofen Plus because you're combining codeine with Nurofen, so two potentially habit-forming, side effect-provoking drugs together. I'm not sure why they let that be over the counter. So I think that one you should be really cautious of. And the first question...
Ventolin,
yes. Ventolin is great for relief of symptoms of asthma. I think it's good it can be bought over-the-counter, so if you know you've got asthma and you've got an attack, you can get the rescue medication. But self-medicating with asthma is dangerous. If you're needing Ventolin more than two times a week, then you need to see a doctor because you might need a preventer. You can have uncontrolled asthma, can be very dangerous. So there's a danger in self-treating your asthma.
Again, good advice. Yeah, we're running out of time. There's just a question here which I thought was helpful, maybe, Jason. Somebody's curious about the difference between a physio and chiropractor, and how do you choose?
Okay.
Knowing that it's a physio going to answer it.
Yeah, that's right. That's
but
right.
Jason is a very objective young man.
Yeah, I've got
man.
A lot of good chiropractic friends. No. Look, yeah, a good chiropractor can be fantastic. I think particularly for joints that are hypomobile, so joints that are very stiff, a good chiropractic, a good manipulation can certainly help with particularly thoracic pain towards the middle of the back, neck pain. Generally, I'd encourage people to perhaps go two, maybe three visits. By that stage, if they're a good chiropractor, you should be feeling pretty good. If they've drawn you into 6 months worth of treatment, then maybe you are being taken for a bit of a ride there. I think long-term self-management strategies are far better. In terms of exercise, keeping your joints moving, the back likes to move, and so walking's fantastic. In terms of physiotherapy, we'd be encouraging people to
perform a simple home exercise program, which might be something as simple as some gentle lumbar rotations, some gentle toe touches. Hydrotherapy is great, particularly for osteoarthritis. I find setting up people with a hydrotherapy program can be quite beneficial. My grandmother, who's sitting down the front here, she won't mind me saying this. She just had a laminectomy, which is the nerve that's been released out of her back. And so we've got her in the pool and we've got her moving on the Pilates bed, and she's doing great now. She's standing up and walking, which
and
is
she's
fantastic.
Here. Well and she's done. Here, good so, on you, Catherine.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think long term, particularly, hydrotherapy is great. And just gentle physical activity can be good for joint health. Yeah.
I just want to say one thing about chiropractic treatment of babies. There is no place for that. There's some movement where chiropractors are doing neck adjustments on infants and palate adjustments on infants, and there's no evidence that does any help, and there's a lot of evidence that can do harm. So don't let your babies, your grandchildren go to a chiropractor.
Yeah, go.
I'll just add on to that as well with choosing a chiropractors or physios, because we have a similar thing with podiatry and physio. The different training and the different schools that the people go to is what gives them that name, but the human body is the same. So we get the same question. Someone comes in and says, I came to you to get some orthotics because I've been seeing a physio for a while, and then the physio was going to make me some orthotics, but I know the physio shouldn't be doing that. And I'm speaking out of term here for podiatry, because there's a lot of podiatrists who are very passionate about this, but I disagree. The name of the person is probably not quite as relevant. You want to know, can you trust this person? And Jay spoke about trust before. Does this person know what they're doing? When they explain to you what the diagnosis is and what they hope to do with the treatment, is that making sense to you? And if you're happy with that relationship and everything feels good, I have no problem with physios doing orthotics. I know a lot of podiatrists that I think shouldn't be going anywhere near it because they hate it. They'll tell me, oh, I don't understand that biomechanics, it's too hard. But then they're issuing orthotics, so it's crazy. So when you do the physio versus chiro battle, who are you seeing? Are you happy with that person? Do you trust them? Are they explaining the diagnosis? Are they explaining the management? And is it making sense? What Jace just touched on, if they're not really diagnosing, if they're not really telling you what the plan is, they're just saying, come and see me twice weekly for the first 3 weeks and once weekly for the next 95 weeks. And then you've got to sort of go, I'll have a think about it.
Okay, look, we're over time, and I know these lovely people. If you've got a burning question, there's a few questions I haven't asked. I've tried to cover all of them. Come and grab them. But it's been a great morning, and it's been fabulous having all these five people giving their broad. So would you like to say thank you to them?